Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for a half hour each weekday morning taking your calls if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith. Be glad to talk to you about those things, or of course if you have a difference of opinion from the host, you're welcome to call about that. We'll be glad to hear you balance comment for us here on any subject that's been discussed here previously. I have an announcement to make for those living in Southern California, especially for those in what's called the Inland Empire, which is actually where I grew up. I grew up in Covina in that general area. And once in a while, we have a gathering in Rancho Cucamonga, which is in the Inland Empire. We've done that a couple times in the past. We're doing it again this Saturday. So all of our listeners in that area, I want you to take note. This Saturday, we have a potluck at 6 and a open Bible discussion with questions and answers at 7. Now, the information about that can be found at our website, which is thenarrowpath.com, under the link that says Announcements. So that's thenarrowpath.com. On the tab that says Announcements, you'll find where we're meeting, time and place and all that, this Saturday evening in Rancho Cucamonga in Southern California. All right, if you'd like to be on the program today, we, of course, would be glad to hear from you, and you can call this number, 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. Our first caller today is actually calling from Tampa, Florida. Theo, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I have been exploring, new churches I would like to get involved in, and one of the church formats that I think I'm feeling drawn to is like maybe the home church movement.
Mm-hmm.
But in my research, I've come across a movement that I was not quite familiar with. It's the non-institutional church movement, I would call it. These are people who, I guess, it seemed like they've gotten disillusioned with institutional churches, and they've just decided that they would, go their own way or just, maintain a relationship or trust that God will lead them in the way he would have them to develop spiritually. And I guess I would just like to know what your thoughts are on that movement, if you're familiar with it.
Well, I'm not familiar with a movement that goes by that name, though I'm not surprised that there might be such a movement. To me, the whole idea of non-institutional church is a broad category, and it includes groups that would call themselves organic church movements, home church or house church movements. There's a lot of different subcategories there. I would say that house churches and what they call organic churches are often are non-institutional. And by non-institutional, what that means is they're leaving, as much as they know how, the unscriptural traditions that have accumulated through the centuries in the church in its institutional form. Of course, for a very long time, the Western Church was the Roman Catholic Church until the Reformation. And that was very institutionalized. In fact, we've just seen the appointment of a new pope, which basically illustrates the institutionalization of the church. The Reformed churches, that is to say the Reformation and the Protestant movement that came from it, also produced what we could call institutional churches. Now, what are we calling institutional? When we say non-institutional, we don't mean disorganized necessarily. Whenever you're going to have more than one person meeting together to do anything, you need to have some form of organization, although it could be left to the Holy Spirit to do the organizing.
Just for the sake of clarity, I don't think what I'm referring to is necessarily like a home church or someone just having service in a different non-traditional manner. I'm referring more to people who do not really believe in like having leadership or any kind of formal organization.
Right.
They're more into just maybe fellowshipping, per se.
So that'd be sort of disorganized church, not just non-institutional. Well, there is such a thing as having fellowship without official leadership. When the Apostle Paul and Barnabas went out on their first missionary journey, they created churches. They planted churches on their way out from Antioch, where they began. And then on their way back, they appointed leaders in those churches. Now, we don't know how much time elapsed between the time they established those churches on their way out from Antioch and the time they returned and appointed leaders in those churches on their way back. It could have been months, and it very possibly was, very probably, in fact, which means that those churches they established didn't have official leaders initially. They had churches, but they weren't defined by leadership. They were defined by being followers of Christ. Now, eventually, Paul and Barnabas came and appointed leaders in those groups. And so there is obviously a place in Scripture for the appointment of leaders. But there's also a place for churches to exist sometimes without leaders. That is, without official leaders. Because leadership is really, the whole philosophy of leadership has everything to do, I think, with the question of whether a church is called institutional or not. When Israel wanted a king, they established an institutional government in Israel. Before that, they had what would have to be called a charismatic government in Israel. Charismatic meaning gifted. When God would raise up a judge, he put his spirit upon him, and that man would have a gift to lead the people, to deliver them and to lead them for his lifetime. But when he died, he did not leave any successor. The country went back to having no leader at all until the next time God raised up a charismatic leader because of another crisis. And for probably 400 or so years, Israel was in that condition without an institutional government. They didn't have central government. They didn't have standing armies. They didn't have any succession of their leaders. And they simply had God as their king. God was the one who raised up leaders as he wished. But then when the leader was gone, it's not like there was an office to be filled. You see, the man himself, the gifted man, was what God provided for leadership. When the gifted man was gone, it's not like there was a vacancy and they had to find a man, gifted or not, to fill the vacancy. And when you do organize things in that way, where you say, okay, we've lost our leader, we need to find another guy to fill in this office, then you have, of course, the idea of succession, organizational, institutional succession. And that's what I think makes an institutional church. Now, a home church or an organic church may not have any appointed leaders. But, of course, they just won't be appointed. They won't have any badge that says, I'm the leader here. But in every group, somebody takes the lead. It might be one person or a few people. Nonetheless, will lead.
I would say it's even more informal than that. At least a couple of the programs I've listened to, these brothers probably just believe in just getting together and just encouraging each other, not really, meeting on a weekly basis or whatever. It's just really informal. And and I guess just from what you shared, like you said, Paul would eventually assign leaders or whatever. Wouldn't that suggest at least that's the preferred format to have leadership and teachers per se, rather than you guys wing it,
Well, it really depends on what the needs of the group are. If the group is not evangelizing and there's no young Christians coming into the group, and everybody in the group is a mature Christian who's a self-feeder, for example, they all study the Bible on their own and maybe together, they may not need someone to get up and teach them in the meeting. For example, although I enjoy hearing teaching from pastors and so forth, if I didn't have a pastor teaching me, I'm a self-feeder. I'd be studying, I'd be reading, I'd be learning. And so are there many other people like that. So if a bunch of people like that get together, they might enjoy having a teacher or not, but that might not be their greatest need. It may be that since they are being fed on a regular basis without gathering, that when they gather, they want some other dynamic of the Christian community to be taking place. The Bible doesn't say what has to happen at a Christian meeting. But I would say that in a healthy and growing church, there's going to be new Christians coming in on a regular basis, hopefully getting saved. that being the case, they're going to need to be taught. They're going to need to be discipled. Now, again, that doesn't have to happen from a pulpit. That could happen one-on-one. It could be that the older Christians in the group will take a younger Christian under their wing individually or in small, you know, informal groupings and disciple them. That's fine, too. The assumptions we have about what's supposed to take place at a church meeting are mostly based on tradition and not necessarily on, you know, direct statements of Scripture that say when you gather, you have to do all these things. So I would say that any group of people that is gathering in the name of Jesus for mutual edification, if they find that what's happening among them is leading to growth and service and edification, then at least for the moment, that may be just fine. Now, it may be that their needs will change as their demographics change or as something happens in their lives, in which case they should also, you know, change what they do in order to meet the needs of the group. I'm pretty much of a non-institutional kind of a guy myself, although I believe that institutional church can also be a venue where God moves and where God ministers. And I personally attend institutional church every Sunday that I can. So, I'm not going to condemn the non-institutional churches because some people are simply doing church in a different way because that's what happens to meet the needs of the people who are participating.
Okay, Steve. That's very helpful. I really appreciate your insight.
Okay, Theo. Good talking to you, bro. Okay.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right. Our next caller is John from Damascus, Oregon. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you, Steve. This morning I was reading in Mark chapter 16, and a couple things came out I wanted to ask you about. First, in light of discussion yesterday afternoon show, which I don't want to get off on a side thing on it, but there was a long conversation with a gentleman about the presence of demonic activity in our lives as Christians. And I was reading through this, and I came across the phrase or the paragraph where he says, now when he rose early in the morning, the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, of whom he had cast out seven demons. And I had just, it hit me that, you know, did they name them? I mean, how would they have known? Is the only reference to the number of demons as Jesus or any of the disciples cast them out?
There's a likelihood that the demons came out one at a time. And so the process could be observed, and they saw that there were seven. Of course, in the case of the man who had a legion of demons, they apparently all came out at once, and we don't know what their exact number was. We know there were many of them. It's possible that Jesus knew the number of demons that came out. You know, we know that Jesus had a conversation with the legion of demons that were in the man of the tombs because we read something of that conversation. Jesus may have had conversations with the demons in Mary Magdalene before he cast them out. We don't know. It is conceivable that in the course of that conversation, there were seven demons that identified themselves, and he cast them all out at once. Okay. Otherwise, he may have cast them out one at a time, as I've seen done also. But, yeah, we don't know exactly the seven demons that were in Mary Magdalene. We have no record of when it happened or how it happened. We're only told about it after the fact.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, then reading further, he's got a few things to say in the Gospel of Mark, more things than the others, before he ascends to heaven, and he says these in verse 17, and these signs will follow those who believe in my name. They will cast out demons. So right there, that's just a part of our, you know, post-resurrection Christian experience that we encounter. They will speak with new tongues. They will take up serpents, and if they drink anything deadly, it will by no means hurt them. They will lay hands on the sick, and they will recover. So to me, when I read this, I almost think that the reference here to the serpents and the poison or the deadly drink is it a figure of speech? And if so, why would it be parked right between two practical things that you can do as a Christian in casting out demons, speaking in tongues, and healing the sick, laying your hands on them?
Yeah, so I don't think it's a figure of speech. No, I don't think it's a figure of speech because as far as taking up serpents and not be harmed, we know in the book of Acts, in chapter 28, Paul was gathering sticks for a fire and a viper bit his hand and attached itself to him, which should have killed him. but he shook the viper off into the fire, and he was unharmed by it. So this is no doubt the kind of thing that Jesus was referring to. As far as drinking deadly things, you know, a lot of the water they'd have to drink as they traveled around would be fairly deadly. I mean, clean drinking water is a luxury we take for granted. But in ancient times, you never really knew if the water you're going to drink someplace really was going to be full of parasites or amoebas or whatever, you know. And so it seems like he may be saying that as the disciples would travel and preach, there would be evidence of God's protection upon them from such things, some of the normal traveling dangers of serpents, you know, deadly drink, and so forth, that God would protect them from it. But also through signs that they would do themselves of casting out demons, laying their hands on the sick, and them recovering, and so forth. Speaking in tongues, he mentions. I believe that these particular things that are listed are not some kind of a guarantee that all Christians can drink deadly liquid and not be hurt, or that all Christians can take up serpents, as some snake handlers try to do. And they find that they do die sometimes when they're bit by these snakes. But I think that he's talking about the fact that where the gospel goes, this kind of sign, this kind of thing will be seen. Not always these signs and not with every person, but wherever the gospel has gone and wherever there are those who believe it, there will be signs that follow. It doesn't mean every person who believes will do all these things. I think it just means that wherever the believers are, those who believe, there will be also supernatural evidence of God's presence, including the casting out of demons and healings and speaking in tongues and his protection from these kinds of natural dangers. But I don't think it's a blanket promise to all Christians that they can be expecting that to happen, you know, at will.
Okay. I can see that completely. And that perspective really does help. I do see how that can apply even our lives today. But that, and the one about the snake and the example of Paul, I also understand that. Is there any, in that specific one, in your experience, have you either read or heard or experienced anything remotely like that? Or should we, as far as picking up a snake or being bit by a viper like Paul was, has that ever, you know, happened to you, or have you heard anybody of that happening, or should we just take that, as you said, of a type experience instead?
Well, to be very honest with you, I know very few people who've been bitten by deadly snakes. You know, I don't live around deadly snakes, and I don't know, I don't have any friends. Well, I do. I have one cousin who had a pet rattlesnake, and he got bit. He lost his thumb. It wasn't innocuous, but then he wasn't a Christian. But no, I can't really give you any examples known to me of people who, you know, were bitten by snakes and were unharmed by it. But then again, I don't know people, any Christians, who were bitten by snakes and were harmed by it either. I just don't know people who've been bitten by snakes very much.
Okay. Well, I'm satisfied with that answer, and that does help give me some perspective. So thank you very much, Steve.
Okay, John. Thanks for your call.
Take
care. Good talking to you. God bless. Okay, our next caller is Wynn, calling from Palos Verdes, California. Wynn, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. My question has to do with, curious as to what your view on the Daniel 70 weeks in Daniel chapter 9. Are they literally fulfilled as 70 weeks of years, or are super 69 weeks fulfilled by the last week is still yet future?
All right, yeah. The 70 weeks of Daniel in Daniel 9, verses 24 through 27, are generally understood by almost all evangelicals to refer to 7-year periods. A week in the Hebrew just means sevens. So there are 77s. And it doesn't say what the item is that's being measured in sevens, but most scholars would agree it means years. So there'd be 70 times 7 years, or 490 years. I take it that way myself. I think that's the best way to understand it. Although there are two very different ways that Christians have understood the last of those 7 years, the last 7, the 70th 7. The popular view today is that 69 of those 7s, or 483 years, passed from the beginning of the time it began in Daniel's day until Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey, and that was at the end of the 69th of these sevens. Those who believe this usually believe there's been a postponement of the 70th week. That is, there's still 7 years, one more seven-year period, unfulfilled, and they believe that will be the Great Tribulation at the end of the world. So they believe there's a gap between the 69th week and the 70th week, a gap that's like been about 2,000 years almost. And so, in other words, the whole period isn't really 490 years, as the prophecy suggests. The whole period is really more like 2,490 years before it's all done. And I don't agree with that. I don't see any evidence in the passage that would suggest there's this big gap there. When you think about it, the gap, if it's a 2,000-year gap, it's four times as long as the whole period itself that's prophesied. So the period, instead of being 490 years, is really five times that long, which is makes it even a bad estimate. So I don't see that there. I don't see any evidence in Daniel that there's going to be such a gap. As I see it, the 70 weeks are divided into three sections. There's 7 and 62 and 1. As you read the passage, there's the 7 weeks, there's 62 weeks, and then there's 1 week. That makes 70. There is no gap between the first 7 weeks and the next 62 weeks that are mentioned. They're mentioned separately, but there's no gap between them. No one sees a gap there. Everyone agrees that 7 weeks plus 62 weeks are 69 consecutive weeks. So to say there must be a gap before the 70th week comes is entirely artificial and not the slightest indication in the passage that's going to happen. I personally believe that Jesus began his ministry at the beginning of the 70th week. So I would differ from the dispensationalists. The dispensationalists say Jesus completed his ministry at the end of the 69th week. I believe he began his ministry at the end of the 69th week, and that the 70th week continued right after the 69th, as you'd expect. So that Jesus was cut off in the midst of the week, 3.5 years into his ministry, he was cut off. That's in the middle of the 70th week. And he caused the sacrifices and offerings to cease, because by his death he brought an end to the sacrificial system. And so that's what I understand the prophecy to be talking about. It's I don't have time to go into it in detail, but if you really would like me to do so, I have on my recorded lectures, which you can hear for free at our website at thenarrowpath.com. If you go to the topical lectures, you can go to Daniel chapter 9 and listen to what I've said about it. Or you can go to the, I'm sorry, that's the verse-by-verse lectures. You can go to the topical lectures, to the series that's called When Shall These Things Be? And there will be a lecture on the 70th week of Daniel there. We're almost out of time. We'll take one more call today. Leo from Chula Vista, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve.
Hi.
Last Thursday and Friday, you were answering questions about the afterlife, talking about Sheol and Gehenna, and where the dead may go. I have a question. What is your take on what is the difference between the spirit and the soul? Are those the same together, or are they separate? And if they're separate, where the spirit goes after death, and where the what happened with the soul? I would take.
Well, that's okay. Thank you for your call, Leo. Good to hear from you. The spirit and the soul may be the same thing, or they may be separate things. And this is something that theologians will perhaps never come to a full agreement about, because the spirit and the soul are mentioned separately from each other, but sometimes they seem to be used interchangeably. And that being the case, there are many scholars, evangelical scholars, who believe the spirit and the soul are the same thing, that man is made up of two parts, his physical body and his non-physical part, or what Paul calls the outer man and the inner man. So that the physical body is one part, and the non-physical part is the spirit or the soul. And the terms can be used interchangeably. In fact, not only those two terms, but the inner man can also be called the heart or the mind. So many people believe that all these terms, heart, mind, soul, spirit, they all speak of the inner part of man's nature, the non-physical, the part that is the spiritual side of man. So this is one view. This is called the dichotomy view. They believe that there's two parts of man, thus the word dichotomy, physical and non-physical, in which case the spirit and soul are the same thing in that thinking. The other view is called the trichotomy view, three parts. And that is the belief that man is made of three parts, body and soul and spirit, three different things. This makes a distinction between the soul and the spirit, though the distinction is not extremely clear. It certainly is not very clear in Scripture, but theologians who make this distinction say that the soul refers to the intellect and the emotions and the will. We might say our personality is our soul. Our intellect, so how what we know, our emotions, what we feel, and our will, which is the choices we make. These are all functions of the soul, it is said. And that's why we get the word psychology. The soul in Greek is psuche or psyche, and psychology is the study of those things, the mind and the emotions and the will. They would say the spirit, on the other hand, is that deeper part of us that is enlivened when we're born again and connects and communes with God. Exactly how we experience the spirit would be a very subjective thing and somewhat impossible to describe under this view. But there are two views. That's all I can say. The Bible cannot be really used finally to solve the question, because the Bible is not clear on whether the soul and spirit are different or whether they are the same. I incline toward the view that they're different, but the distinctions are very hairline, very hard to tell you what they are, especially now since I'm going to be cut off in 20 seconds. I appreciate your call, though, Leo. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. We are a listener-supported ministry. You can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, to get our resources for free or to donate if you wish. thenarrowpath.com. God bless.
Will you help us bless this ministry? If what you just heard is valuable to you, especially if you're a regular listener to this outreach, please leave us a comment that we can send to them. We're calling it Project Encouragement, where we let our programmers hear from people they may otherwise never hear from. All you do is call 800-227-2337, extension 311, and follow the prompts. We'll send your comments to the folks behind this program so they can be encouraged by your words. You like being appreciated, and they are no different, so let them know. Call as soon as you can. 800-227-2337, extension 311.
I want to encourage you to take that number down and then leave an encouraging word for the ministry of The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. It would mean a lot to him to hear from his listeners, so please take a moment and call today. Here's that number again. It's 800-227-2337, extension 311. Or just go to KBRT740.com for more information. Up next, it's Joyce Meyer on AM 740 KBright.
The oldest and largest Christian station in Southern California, 50,000 watts strong. KBRT and KBRT HD Costa Mesa, and on the web at KBRT740.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her series entitled Let God Fight Your Battles. In life, there are many battles that we will encounter. Some deal with our friends and family, others deal with health issues, and some with financial difficulties. But no matter how big the battle may seem, it's encouraging to know that Christ has given us power to win them. In today's teaching, Joy shares how you can secure real victory in life with a genuine relationship with God. Everything you'll hear today can be found in Joyce's four-part CD teaching, Let God Fight Your Battles. When you order today's offer, you'll also receive her book, The Battle Belongs to the Lord. Just visit JoyceMeyer.org and get your copy today. Now, here's Joyce with today's teaching entitled, Let God Fight Your Battles.
Luke chapter 10, verse 38. Now, while they were on their way, it occurred that Jesus entered a certain village, and a woman named Martha received and welcomed him into her house. She had a sister named Mary who seated herself at the Lord's feet and was listening to his teaching. She saw an opportunity and she immediately took advantage of it. You know, it's good to have a plan, but we always have to be willing to ditch our plan if Jesus shows up. It's good to have a plan. I'm a person who plans, but you have to let God interrupt you when he wants to. Don't wear a do not disturb sign around your neck. Let God be the driver in your life. So Jesus showed up. I don't know if they knew he was coming. It doesn't even sound like they knew he was coming. He came by. Jesus is here. Well, Mary immediately took advantage of it, sat down at his feet to hear his teaching. But Martha, overly occupied and too busy. How many of you see that? Overly occupied and too busy, was distracted. What are some of the roadblocks to intimacy with God? We get distracted with all the things that we think we have to do, much of which we do not have to do. We're just addicted to busy activity. So she came up to him and said, "Lord, is it nothing to you that my sister has left me to serve?" You see, she's working.